Okay, it's a tremendous pleasure to be here in Ottawa, and it's my second time. We were here at the wedding of our son Andy and Sarah, and it's very wonderful to be here, and we should always meet at times of simplest and positive good things to work for everyone we use anywhere. Now, the Rambam, today is Rosh Chodesh Nisan, first day of Nisan, and the Rambam figures in Nisan, the lead up to Pesach, because the birthday of the Rambam was on Erev Pesach. He was born in Spain, in Cordova, in 1135, that's the general view, and the idea of course, being born on Erev Pesach, that was a very active few days around there. I'd like to just briefly outline a little bit about his life. He lived briefly in Spain, then there came the Almohade persecution. The Almohades were a fanatical breed of Muslim who began forcing Islam on everyone, and many Jews had to flee. And his family, he was a child, but his family fled to North Africa, and then they went through North Africa, and eventually he ended up in Fustat, in the old city of Cairo in Egypt. And there he became a physician. There was an earlier time in his life when his brother David had supported him, but then unfortunately his ship sank and he died. And now the Rambam had to support himself, and he was a physician. And he was a physician in the court of the Sultan. And there's quite interesting historical records about that. And he was also the leader of the Jewish community. And his son, Rabbi Avraham, the son of the Rambam, became the official chief rabbi of the community. And his son was the chief rabbi, and in fact that was a dynasty. That means son after father, son, and then the next son down. For about two centuries, the chief rabbi of Egypt was a descendant of the Rambam. The fact about Rabbi Avraham is an interesting thing, because Rabbi Avraham, the son of the Rambam, was a very spiritual teacher. And there is even a term used by academics for the teachings of Rabbi Avraham and his son, which have been recorded in Arabic and are studied in universities. It's called Egyptian Hasidism. It's a rather strange term. You see, there's the first time we use the term Hasidism in historical terms is relating to the time of Hanukkah, that the Maccabees were called Hasidim, and the Talmud refers to them and that period as the Hasidim HaRishonim, the early Hasidim. So Hasidim in this sense means pietist. So then we have, a little bit later, we have German Hasidism, which is a movement in the 12th and 13th centuries focused around a figure called Rabbi Yehuda Hasid, who is mentioned in the Tosafot, and there were people of the Baalei HaTosafot, people who wrote the Tosafot on the Talmud, who were also among the Hasidei Ashkenaz, the German Hasidism, the German Hasidim, the pietists of Germany. We then have the lesser known Egyptian Hasidism of the descendants of the Rambam, and finally, a long time later, we have in the 18th century the rise of the Hasidic movement with the Baal Shem Tov. So the word Hasidism is used quite widely. In modern Hebrew, Hasid means a follower. Ani lo Hasid shel Barak, a person says that. I do follow this team, or whatever it might be. So there you have the use of language in Jewish thought and history. It's always fascinating. Now, the Rambam wrote some very significant works. He was trying to communicate Judaism, so he wrote an Arabic translation of the Mishnah, an Arabic commentary on the Mishnah, which is written in Arabic and Hebrew letters. And that was Judeo-Arabic, rather like Yiddish is a form of Old German in Hebrew letters, or Ladino is Spanish in Hebrew letters. So there's Judeo-Arabic as well. And that commentary on the Mishnah includes in its introduction a wonderful introduction to the whole concept of the Talmud, which has been translated into English and is a very useful book to read to understand the nature of what the Talmud is and the whole system of the sages. There are two translations of which I know, there are probably a few more, and they're usually called an introduction to the Talmud. It's in fact the introduction to his commentary on the Mishnah. Very, very interesting work, warmly to be recommended. There is also, within his commentary on the Mishnah, when it comes to Perek Chelek in Sanhedrin, which says every Jew has a portion in the world to come, and then it goes on to say, and these are the ones who don't have a portion in the world to come, one who says this or that. So the Rambam says, well, what defines Judaism? And he writes the 13 principles of faith, which are a famous part of the Rambam's legacy to us. They're printed in many Siddurim, and prayer books have them. Now, he also wrote the Mishneh Torah, which is a large work. I think I just counted 26 of these volumes in the bookshelf in the other room. And it's a large work which covers the entire Talmud and is explaining the laws and teachings of the Talmud. The Talmud itself is a very complex work. When you open any page, it's exciting, it's thrilling, it's beautiful, but it is not systematic in terms of learning basic points of Jewish law. For example, there is a thick tractate, Shabbat, and in the whole of that tractate, although it tells us all about the 39 categories of work which are forbidden to be done on Shabbat, it does not actually mention Kiddush. Making Kiddush, we have to find about in the last chapter of Tractate Psachim, where it talks about making Kiddush at the Seder. That's where we learn the laws of Kiddush. So you would have to, and as we had in an interesting share yesterday, looking at the laws of Muktzah, you have to look at this page and then at another page, and you have to be able to put them together in the right way in order to understand what those laws are. So the Rambam wrote a new formulation of the teachings in the Talmud. So as well as having, for example, these are a few that I selected just to illustrate. This is Hilchot Chametz Matzah, laws of Chametz Matzah, very, very topical for the coming Pesach. And reading it will no doubt make one feel more relaxed about the Pesach cleaning, because the actual halakha is much more lax than the way in which the stringently Jewish housewives through the generations stringently apply. So there we have the laws of Chametz and Matzah. That's one kind of example of his writing in this work. Now another is Hilchot Beit HaBchira, laws of the temple. Because unlike all the other codes of law, which are sort of simplifying and categorizing the legal teachings, the halachic teachings of the Talmud, the Tor, the Rosh, the Rif, the Shulchan Aruch, the Rambam included all Jewish law, including laws which only apply in the time of the temple. So Mishneh Torah is the only totally comprehensive work of Jewish law. It also, now in terms of this sort of Jewish legal dimension, there are works which you could say are, they're very profound, but they may be peripheral to the whole flow of Jewish history and of Jewish thought. And there are other works which are central. Now Mishneh Torah is central because when Rabbi Yosef Karo came to write the Shulchan Aruch, he took three pillars on which he was basing the Shulchan Aruch, and the Rambam was one of them. And so therefore, the Rambam's view of the halakha informs our formulation in the Shulchan Aruch of what the halakha actually is. So there we have the halachic legal dimension of Mishneh Torah. We also have another aspect of Mishneh Torah. It codifies areas which we may not think of as something needing codification, or no one had thought of in that sort of way, like Hilchot Tshuva, the laws of repentance. Now, we might think that that would fit more into a kind of a Musa book or something like that, but the Rambam saw this as a halachic issue. What are the laws of repentance? And similar kind of teachings about the more personal and spiritual relationship with the divine. And another aspect of his writing in the Mishneh Torah is Hilchot Yesodei HaTorah, laws of the foundations of the Torah, which is part of the very beginning, Sefer Hamadah, the Book of Knowledge. The whole Mishneh Torah is in 14 sections that the Rambam made. And we have the basic principles of the Torah. And here he talks about the relationship of the divine with existence, and the whole idea of the concept of God, and how one can imagine God without the world, but you can't imagine the world without God. A very interesting formulation there. Now that's Mishneh Torah, which is something which in every single yeshiva, most synagogues, and many homes, there is a set of Mishneh Torah by the Rambam, the repetition of the Torah. There's another book, which is much more rare in the Jewish home, synagogue, or study house. This was written in Judeo-Arabic and has been translated. At an early stage, it was translated into Hebrew and has been translated into English. Guide of the Perplexed, or Guide for the Perplexed. And this is, it would seem, clearly a philosophical work. It's a work of philosophy. One way in which it can be understood is that in terms of a society, which was really the writings of the Greek philosophers, which had been translated into Arabic by Arabic scholars who were fascinated with Greek thought, and this was now accessible to the Jews, and the Jews were becoming very confused by it, because Aristotle had a concept of existence in which miracles were not possible, and various other points of contradiction with basic Jewish beliefs. And so the Rambam wrote his Guide for the Perplexed, mediating the whole issue of Aristotelian thought for the Jews of his time. Now, here we hit on a conflict. Because when the Rambam passed away, a little shades of this conflict began before he passed away, but particularly straight on, soon after. Sorry? Did you want to ask a question? No. Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah, no problem. No problem. Soon after the Rambam passed away, there began to be a conflict about his writings, generated partly by some rabbis in Provence and also taken up by some rabbis in North France. So we're talking here about, he passed away 1204, that is just over 800 years ago. So there we have the time of the Baalei HaTosfot and Rav Yonah Gorondi, it's that sort of period. And there began to be an argument about the guide for the perplexed, this philosophical work, and the Sefer Hamadah, the Book of Knowledge in his Mishneh Torah. And unfortunately, the Dominican monks were fiercely investigating heresy in the Catholic Church. At that point, it was only the Catholics, and it was before the Reformation. And they were burning books here and there. And so, unfortunately, someone went to the Dominicans and said, well, we have a heretical book as well, and maybe you'd like to burn this. And so they burnt that. They burnt the Guide for the Perplexed. very tragically, this is the way it's seen by some people analyzing this issue, the Christians up to that point had thought that the Jews are terrible because they hadn't converted to Christianity, but they thought of Judaism as a thing that you leave intact. The idea with their books, and you don't interfere with their actual books, the idea that some Jewish books were heretical, that was a fascinating idea, and it provoked further investigation promoted by some Jewish converts to Christianity. And so you have an accusation against the Talmud in 1240, so not very long after, that the Talmud is heretical. And as a result of this accusation, why is the Talmud heretical? Not because it quotes Aristotle, it doesn't quote Aristotle. The Talmud's heretical, they claimed, because it says God weeps because he destroyed the temple. Now, who can imagine God weeping? God is all powerful. So to say that God weeps and that he destroyed the temple, so it must mean that this is a heretical statement. Or, after the destruction of the temple, Ein la HaKadosh Baruch Hu ba'olamo ele dalet amot shel halacha bilvad. After the destruction of the temple, God only has the 4 cubits of halacha. How can you say such a thing? Infinite, omnipotent God has only got the 4 cubits of halacha. Heresy. They found 30 points, something like 30. That sort of number of points on which to argue. Rabbi Yechiel of Paris, Rabbi Moshe of Kusi, they tried to defend the Talmud, and unfortunately, soldiers came to every Jewish house in France, took out all the manuscripts they could find, which, as far as they were concerned, they probably were right, were all Talmudic manuscripts of one kind or another, and they burnt them in a huge number of cartloads. I think it was 24 cartloads of manuscript books being destroyed in Paris, and that effectively wiped the Torah study out of France, and it then moved eastwards into Poland and Germany, away, Germany and then Poland. And it is said that Rabbi Yonah Garondi wrote his book Shari Tshuva as a gates of repentance, as an expression of repentance about this error of burning the Rambam's work, which was seen by certain figures and very rationally as causing such a terrible effect, apart from the issue in itself. So there was this conflict. There were the people opposing Maimonides, and there were also very fierce defenders of the Rambam, very fierce and vigorous figures. And there was Rav Moshe ben Nachman, Nachmanides. He, like the typical mediator, he understood both sides of the story. He understood why the people in North France thought these works were heretical. They thought they were heretical because they quote philosophy of Aristotle, and as it might well be, a person could start studying these works and get himself, not what the author intended necessarily, but get himself some kind of introduction to Aristotelian thought, which, who knows, or some kind of misreading of what the Rambam himself was writing, and carry himself off in the wrong direction. For example, in the 18th century, there was a figure called Solomon. Well, he took a surname. He took the surname Maimon because he wanted to express his affinity to the great Rambam. So there is Solomon Maimon. We're now in the 18th century, and we're in Eastern Europe. And he and a friend of his began reading Moreh Nevuchim, Guide for the Perplexed. He writes this in his autobiography, written in German later on in his life. He says, so they began reading Guide for the Perplexed, and the guide says that the purpose of the mitzvah is to make you into a more spiritual, more elevated and refined person. So he and his friend said to each other, we're already spiritual, we're already refined. We don't have to keep mitzvah because we've achieved what the mitzvah are supposed to achieve. So that's, and he called himself Solomon Maimon. He left the Jewish community, went to Germany, became a very fashionable philosopher who's supposed to have had significant influence on the later course of German philosophy. So there we have someone seeing the Rambam as his mentor, going in a direction we would say is very much a negative direction. But Nachmanides said, yes, that's, I can see this possibility. That's why the rabbis in North France are against him. But do you know, the Rambam wrote a very moving letter about this, a few very moving letters. They're all collected in a book called Kitab al-Rasail, which was edited by Rabbi Yaakov Emden. He said, do you know why the Rambam was writing about philosophy? Because there are people, there are Jews who are reading philosophic writings, and they're going completely astray, and they do not understand how Judaism and modernity at that particular point and philosophy fit together, and the Rambam is showing them a path. So he said to the North French, I understand what you're saying, but you're wrong, because the Rambam is right to do what he is doing. Okay, so now we then have, if we we move on to our more specific topic, is the Rambam a rationalist or a mystic? Because we can see, at this juncture, we can see that on the one hand, the Rambam, as viewed by certain people and a certain aspect of his writing, has this philosophical, what might then be called rationalist, is from the point of view of Solomon Maimon. The Rambam was a rationalist, and the force of rationalism in modern society, modern meaning the last 200 years, it's always very amusing what historians call modern, what we call modern, what they call modern. The computer is modern if it's in the last 3 years. But as far as Jewish history is concerned, if it's since the French Revolution or even before, it's modern, even slightly before. So there's modern, there's early modern, that's before the Revolution. So the process of modernity in terms of rationalization is also a process that Max Weber called disenchantment. Disenchantment means that the object, let's say, it's got a certain quality. These lovely cookies which are here on the table, they are kosher. And there might be something else which is not kosher. So, you know, the look of the object might be very similar. One has got this aura of being kosher, and another one has a negative aura of being not kosher. So this Weber would term, you know, the enchantment of the world. If you look at everything in the world, everything is either positive, it's a pure or impure, kosher, not kosher. Ultimately, you get to the issue of permitted, forbidden. And when you disenchant the world entirely, you get to a situation where it doesn't make any difference. And unfortunately, that's the sliding process of rationalization, secularization, and the way in which all values eventually disappear. But that way of looking at the process of rationalization, there is another force and another aspect to the Rambam, which is not only that he is a halachist. See, you can be a halachist in a very rational way, and in theory. I'm actually very intrigued by this mental position, this cultural position, because to me, everything in halacha is talking about a connection with the divine. So the divine immediately is a step where a finite human being is connecting with infinite divine. God told us to do a mitzvah, like eat kosher and don't eat not kosher, and we are fulfilling that mitzvah. That is something potentially a very, very spiritual idea. That's a phenomenal thing that a finite human being is able to keep this law of the divine And when we come to the writings of spiritual teachers, mystics of different kinds, and the Hasidim, you have the idea that the mitzvah, which in itself means command, can also be understood in other terms in relation to an Aramaic word, tzavta, which means a group, a tzevet, like a crew, the crew of the tank. It's called the tzevet, a tzevet shalapan. The crew, because they're all bonded together, and the mitzvah is the tzavta v'chibur, it's the bond joining us to the divine. So when we keep the positive mitzvah or the negative mitzvah, we don't eat the non-kosher cookie. And when it comes to Pesach night, 2 weeks' time, and we eat the matzah of the Seder night, which is a positive mitzvah from the Torah, at that moment we are being bonded to the divine. It's an incredible moment. Please, at the Seder night, enjoy it, because at that moment when you're eating, you say, Anachilat Habotzi Lechem in Aretz, and then the blessing, Anachilat Matzah, at that moment you're being, we're all of us being bonded to the divine. And therefore there's the idea of one has to try and eat a kazayit of matzah. It shouldn't just be a little bit of nibbling of matzah, but a whole kazayit, which is half a matzah, depending on whether a machine-made matzah, at least a whole matzah, or the nice hand-baked matzah, could be a half. Within 4 minutes, 5 minutes, you know, everything in halakha has measures, shiurim. So that's a connection with the divine. But you could imagine a kind of more or less rationalist approach, or which doesn't stress the spiritual dimension. Because, of course, spirituality, you know, suddenly someone, if they're infused with the spiritual, who knows what might happen? Like we have in Parshat Shmini, we have the two sons of Aaron, too excited with the spiritual, or the four people who entered Pardes, only one of which were entered in peace and came out in peace in the Talmud in Chagigah. So there's a fear of spirituality. Now, does the Rambam represent a kind of rational, logical, you know, watertight, cut and dried attitude to Jewish thought? Which on the left side of the picture would have this whole rationalist philosophic dimension as exhibited by this these conflicts about him, or is he expressing a mystical strand of Jewish thought? Well, this is discussed by scholars in the year 2004. It was the 800th anniversary of the Rambam's passing away, and there were several conferences around the world about the Rambam, academic conferences. There were in the Torah world as well, I suppose, but focusing on the academic conferences, there was one in London University, which I took part in, and some of the points that I'll be sharing with you today are drawn from that talk. There was also a conference that was just generally about the Rambam, people giving the Rambam as a doctor, as a physician, the Rambam as a philosopher. There was also a conference in Bar-Ilan University at the same time, roughly, which was about the Rambam as a mystic. Was the Rambam a mystic? So there, I would say that in my conference, the general trend, with the exception of my paper, but for most of the papers were about the Rambam as either rationalist or physician, but in Bar-Ilan was the other focus, the Rambam as mystic, so I'd like to share with you a few of these ideas. Now, the point is, there was a rabbi from Manchester in England. He originally was in Germany, Alexander Altman, Alav HaShalom. He was actually at university together with the late Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Soloveitchik, Rabbi Altman, and Rabbi Schneerson were all together in university in Berlin at the same time, and they would meet together and talk. I know about this because a dear professor of mine, an elderly gentleman living in London, he was a friend, Ibadul Mechaim Lechaim, He was a close friend of Alexander Altman and would often stay with him. These are things that Altman told him, and he told me, he shared with me. So there were these three rabbis. Now, Alexander Altman went on, he became a rabbi in the Manchester Beit Din, but eventually he left that, and he became a very prominent professor in the University of Alabama. And then he was in Berkeley, I think. So he was a prominent professor, so Rabbi Soloveitchik became the Rav, as he's called, in New York, and the head of Yeshiva University, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe became the head of the Lubavitcher Hasidic movement. So you have sort of three approaches to Judaism, in one room sometime in 1931 or something like that in Berlin. Altman, in 1936, he wrote an article, Was the Rambam a Mystic? And he wrote it, and he comes with he doesn't think the Rambam's a mystic, although the Rambam does talk about mystical ideas, but which could be understood as mysticism. Moshe Idel, a famous professor of today, has also explored this question. But the interesting thing is that there were mystics at the time of the Rambam, or shortly after the Rambam, who did see the Rambam as a mystic. And that's an incredible idea. You see, in the Guide for the Perplexed, one of the earliest forms of Jewish mysticism in the Mishneh Torah, in fact, in both, you have what he describes as Ma'aseh Bereshit, the work of creation, and Ma'aseh Merkava, and the work of the chariot. Now, these are two categories, the Talmud in Chagiga tells us, these are two early categories of Jewish mysticism. So people studied Ma'aseh Bereshit, or they studied Ma'aseh Merkava, the work of the chariot, or they studied both, or sometimes you have one who knew one,